Welcome, everyone. You're listening to Paradigm Shifters. And I have a wonderful paradigm shifter today, which I always say because it's always true. But this one is quite unique. She is someone who brings a powerful sensitivity and a spiritual pathway into your world and mine. Alex Utterman, who is a devotee of Sri Kaleshwar, and also his lineage of Shirdi Baba, Jesus Christ, Mother Divine. And Alex has spent a fair number of years in India learning a great deal. But Alex, I'm so excited that you're not afraid to step right into the crazy U.S. world of politics and various other things in your service. So welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much, Veronica. It's a real pleasure.
It is a pleasure, actually, to watch you in action covering many, many aspects of being a human being in this time in history. Can you tell us a little bit about what got you to India? Why? What was going on and what happened?
Oh, yeah, sure. I have to say, I think my life prior to all of that was the life of a reluctant mystic.
Oh, I've been there. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. I was deeply, deeply skeptical about things that were spiritual. I had no love for organized religions of any kind. I was fascinated with all religions and read a fair amount about them. And I knew generally some things about the underlying universal quality and beliefs of the different religions, and had a lot of respect for the mystics in all traditions, especially because I feel like despite their tradition, they transcend whatever the particularities of a religious path are, and they go to the more universal consciousness truth. So I had a little bit of that awareness, but honestly, I was a deep skeptic. And I kind of got broadsided by spirituality. I never went looking for it. And
are you saying it came looking for you?
It did, yeah. I often used to joke I was being stalked by God. Because I certainly was not a seeker by any stretch of the imagination. And that all culminated in 1999 when I met a miraculous healing saint who was at the time 27 years old, an Indian man named Kaleshwar, who was renowned already by the ripe old age of 27 for having miraculous healing abilities, including dissolving terminal cancers, HIV, really serious conditions that were facing people. And he came to the U.S. I was utterly dazzled by the energy that I saw around him, by the unconditional love that he emanated, and through the use of the miraculous energy, I was utterly stunned. And I thought, my God, I've been waiting for this my whole life. This is what I came to do. And I was about 32 when all that happened. So shortly after meeting him, I was on a plane to India for the first time, where I witnessed what he did in the West were small miracles that were kind of like what he called chocolates for children, that a child won't pay such good attention to you unless you give them a piece of chocolate. And
right.
While they're eating the candy, then suddenly you have their attention for 5 minutes. So to the souls that he was interested in helping, develop healing abilities or attracting to come and go deeper in India, it really was an amazing time to see miraculous manifestations. He would produce objects out of thin air and give them to people to use for healing. The objects would carry the power of the manifestation or of a teleportation, and that would transfer to other people in a healing way. So I had seen him manifest objects out of nothing. I had seen him produce ash from his fingertips to heal people quite dramatically. And then I went to India and I saw full-scale miracles that were so in your face as to be almost not believable when described. And a lot of those large-scale miracles were directly linked to Christ.
What do you mean by that? Do you mean that... okay, can you explain what is able to create miracles through someone like that? And I know the Christ lineage does that. So can you explain it a little bit?
Meaning?
How does it work?
That's a great question, actually. How does it work? It's a culmination, I think, of several factors. One is having done enough spiritual work inside, and by that I mean a lot of sadhana, a lot of mantras, a lot of exact spiritual formulas, which is what we were trained in all the years that I lived in India with Kaleshwar. Developing those mantras inside, creating enough purification in the whole system that the soul is super strong, then it's able to link much more to the cosmic power that's always flowing. The miracles are nothing but the God energy in motion, in action, in this physical illusion 3D world. So it takes having enough soul power, I think, to link to the cosmic energy and have it flow through in a clean way, number one. It also takes the underpinning of unconditional love, which isn't something that any of us come to naturally in this planet. It's a tough world that we're born into, and each of us is carrying a lot of baggage, either from this or other lifetimes, and a lot of heartbreak, actually.
So the mantras, do you think the mantras just like purify us so that we get to touch those places? Are they purification tools, vibrational?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, you know, the metaphor in the Indian tradition is the dust on the mirror. They can't see your accurate face in the mirror because there's so much dust covering it. But when you start to do the practices, especially the really high Shakti, high power mantras, it's starting to pull away the dust layer by layer by layer by layer. Then you can see accurately, oh my God, what is my soul flame? Who am I really? What am I? Once that reflection is pretty clear in the mirror, then all kinds of things are available. You know, it says in the Christian tradition that people were made in God's image. And if that's true, then begs the question, then why aren't human beings showing miraculous abilities, given that God is miraculous, right? I mean, we wouldn't call it God if it weren't supernatural, if there weren't something extraordinary going on. Otherwise, why would we bother to address something like that? But if we are the same stuff, and of course we are, then how come we can't access those abilities and those capacities? And the answer lies in the layers and layers and layers of, you know, the dust, the karmic baggage that everybody's carrying. So how to plow through enough of that so that the soul can really show itself in myriad ways as the shining light that it is. Some people just emanate the beauty and the bliss of the God energy. That's great. Other people turn it into physicalized action. Miracles also, you know, like taking illness and turning it into health. And I've seen over the years hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of truly outright miraculous healings that have occurred through me, through my colleagues, through Kaleshwar, what he used to do, and how he showed us these different ways to approach the energy channel. So I think that's also a kind of manifesting or a kind of transformation in the physical realm. Something that was a disease is suddenly inspiration. And there's no trace of the physical problem that was there. It's amazing, actually.
That's very exciting.
It's normal.
So what is it, for example, what does it take for a person to receive that? Does a person have to be aligned, have to be sharing the mantra with you?
For somebody to receive a miraculous healing?
Yes.
No, their heart just has to be open. That's all.
That's really brilliant.
And it doesn't even have to be open to God per se, or it doesn't have to be open to the healer per se. It just has to be some small corner of the heart has to be open to receive it. And if that opening is there, then really, honestly, God, miraculous things can happen very quickly.
Isn't that interesting? So this is a funny little question here, but what about India, which has these huge peaks of consciousness and this incredible squalor? Is that not kind of a feisty adversity for us to cogitate?
I think it's a big challenge to humanity, actually.
I think it is, too.
What I see about the things that are really divine is that they have a lot of smoke screen around them, so that a lot of people get thrown off by the appearance and won't even go near it. The divinity, the real power divinity, is often hidden in plain sight. And I think India is a great example of that, that the poverty and all the things that the Western nations have a problem with, or allege they have a problem with, about India, it keeps a lot of people out. It's like a kind of screen. If you're not willing to pay the price of that illusion, to walk through, you know, cities that are, you know, have a lot of beggars or a lot of very, very poor people in it or whatever, then you're not eligible to see what's there and what's the backdrop of what India is and has been for millennia. You know, it's one of the only contiguous civilizations on our planet from ancient days. Egypt fell, Rome fell, Sumeria fell. India, however, remained.
Now tell me.
China, two, three different iterations, but India kept its spiritual greatness and its vibration. So that's lurking right under the surface.
But it has vibration in the land, does it not? Is there not a huge rapport? Yeah.
That's my God. Well, think about, you know, over the millennia, hundreds of thousands of divine souls, saints of all walks, all stripes, all religions, all traditions, meditating there. On that ground, infusing that ground with that energy, that divine force, and then leaving their bodies there. Mm-hmm. And again, and again, and again, and again. Yeah, even when you land in the airport, or at least it was my experience the first time I came to India, the second I stepped off the plane, I was befuddled by what I felt, which was this kind of shimmering, scintillating, vibrational energy. And I thought, my God, where have I come? Crazy. What is this? It was so subtle and it was so alive that it actually took me aback. And I also noticed that intuitions were super strong, or any impulsive thought that I had, like a stray, oh, that would be nice kind of thought, would instantly manifest.
Oh, wow. Really?
Like, what is this? This is wild. Yeah. And it's because of the vibration there. So the property is a kind of, you know, it's a smokescreen, one level. The other way that I see it is that Yogananda, the great saint who spent most of his life in America and left his body here in Los Angeles, actually, when he died, he made a really interesting statement, you know, that India in the 1500s was the wealthiest place in the world. That's not that long ago. And
no.
That India had, unfortunately, and I say unfortunately as a little bit of a loaded word, but it went more focused in the spiritual to the detriment of the material abundance, and lost a lot of its materiality because of that. And it's a kind of imbalance. And Yogananda's observation was that India would, as many Western people were incarnating in India, then India would rise economically again, and that the West would rise spiritually. And I think we're seeing that. I think we see a lot of souls incarnating in the West who clearly lived many, many lives in India, and vice versa. And so we're starting to see a kind of harmony and a balance coming back in to India itself.
That's really fascinating, isn't it? The sort of the history of it all. What about Tibet? Is it related to the Himalayas are also loaded with terrific healing energy and very, very high beings,
they are.
Right?
Yeah, a lot of mysticism there.
And
yeah,
it's kind of budding up. They're connected, are they not?
Yeah.
So I want to go into several directions. A lot of us in the spiritual mode have been so frustrated with the egregious nature of our political system, for example, and the greed. I mean, incredible greed. And I noticed that you're very courageous about standing strongly for the possibility of change during this election preparation. Do you want to give us some sort of perspective on all that?
Sure. Yeah, I think, wow, there's so much to say. I've never been of the opinion that spirituality is somehow in a separate box as a compartment in my life or indeed in anyone's life. I don't think that quote-unquote spiritual people can't or shouldn't be also quote-unquote political people.
But some of us were taught that, Alex.
Sure. And I mean, if you want that kind of a life, okay, but I don't think it's appropriate, especially when the world is changing and hinging on so many things so powerfully. It depends on people and their good wishes and their prayers and their good hearts and all. But, you know, when I was growing up, I didn't grow up with a religious family. In fact, my parents were both medical people, and we veered more towards science and skepticism.
Oh.
But nonetheless, the heroes of my household were Martin Luther King Jr., Albert Schweitzer, and Mahatma Gandhi. All three men of tremendous service on the planet and tremendous courage and conviction, and also deeply faithful, deeply religious people, but who drew on their faith who translated their faith into action, into works for mass amounts of people, including really quite radical change making. So I see absolutely no distinction in the field of activism and spirituality. I think spirituality at its best is going to upset status quo, whoever and whatever it is, because we're all living in this beautiful bubble illusion of this world, and we think it's real, and it's not. So coming out the gate, each one of us in a human birth is thinking, oh, this is real. But it's not. It's a Maya. It's a temporary reality. It's a smoke and mirror show. It's like a movie that we're all playing in. At the end of the day, when you drop your body, you know, you're 6 feet under, none of this cinema show matters. That's not the reality. The coming and going, the ebbs and flows, the ups and downs, all these things, it's temporary. Even human history is, you know, it happened, but it didn't happen. Mm-hmm. It's a big fiction that the divine is playing with itself to kind of entertain itself and educate itself about its own nature through all of us. So,
but sometimes in the middle of the squeeze, it's hard to say, oh, this is just an illusion. We're given the ability to feel pain, right?
It's hard or it isn't. It depends on how you look at it. And it also depends on how much soul capacity you have. If your soul is really strong, sure. I mean, your leg can be caught in the trap and you're appreciating that it's an illusion, even while the pain is there. And you also recognize the pain is illusory. And that's not to say, you know, if you break your leg in this illusion world that you don't go to an illusion doctor and have it set. Of course you do. I mean, we also have to be practical, but I think that's where we come back to the fusion of spirituality and activism. You know, the political reality is that many, many people, let's take the U.S. right now.
Yes, please.
Are really suffering. There's a lot of injustice, right? There's a lot of economic.
Huge. Mm-hmm.
Horrible injustice. I feel like we're rapidly going back to the feudal system and the 1% and the corporate interests and the powers of greed, as you mentioned in the beginning, are taking over and are really squeezing the life out of the average person. And to me, that's untenable. My spirituality says, hey, you have to love everybody and you have to treat them the way that you would want to be treated yourself. Well, I wouldn't want to be treated as a third class citizen. I'm already a woman, so that puts me one rung down from the white male society. Fine. If I were a woman of color, I'm like three rungs down. And I often reflect on this, you know, the economic inequality and the social inequality. If I get stopped by a policeman, I don't have to think for a moment that I might end my life in jail within 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm a person of color, that's a pretty good reality.
Ew. But how do we accept that as an illusion and not get mad, huh?
Well, you have to get angry with it. Good. You can get angry with the illusion.
Okay, good.
Seeing it, but because, you know, that kind of fire that comes means you can change something.
Right.
It has to change. We have full right within the illusion to change it, you know. So what I see is that I wouldn't want to be treated like that.
No.
So why should anybody be treated like that? You know, I think Christ was the ultimate sort of special Democrat, really, because he, or as Molly Ivins, the great Texas columnist, once called him, the original bleeding heart liberal, which I think is very funny. You know, but he stood for the underprivileged. He stood for the people who had nothing.
Yes.
You know, he stood against corruption and greed and power over and egoism and, you know, the corrupted power that we see so often passed for power in this world.
And I love that old biblical thing that said, and there he was kicking the
money changers out of the temple. Absolutely.
And I keep saying on Facebook, when are we going to see that, you guys, you born-againers?
Right?
Come on.
Yeah, right. Right. And he wasn't pacifistic about that, right? He was furious.
He was mad. Yeah, I know. That's great.
Well, of course. Uh-huh. So, you know, in the Indian tradition, they portray the Mother Divine. I mean, she has many, many faces. Mother is like the creator of the whole planet. She is the keeper of the illusion. She's the maker and the breaker of the illusion.
But is that why Kali represents her?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Kali, Durga, Lakshmi, Saraswati. I mean, she's a million faces. But many of her faces are in a fierce aspect with a lot of weapons.
Right.
And she's often in the stories on the battlefield, killing the demons who usually represent the negative qualities of humanity, the egoism, the greed, the selfishness, the jealousy, the unworthiness, the anger, the whatever it is. So why is God armed to the teeth ready to do battle. And doesn't that sound, in a metaphysical sense, like what it is to take care of humanity on a social level? I think it's everybody's responsibility.
You mean to be mad and to be battle for the sake of the higher good for all?
You can be angry in a dharmic way, in a way, exactly, that uplifts everybody.
That's like the Bhagavad Gita. That's all about too, right?
Well, that's do your duty and leave the results to God. You have to play your own role. And if your role is slated to make change, look at Martin Luther King. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a man of extreme faith and extreme conviction and a real sharp clarity about this is unacceptable. And looking around and seeing people oppressed and living in segregation and in poverty in this country, you know, and under the oppression of the white majority in the South, oh my God. Unacceptable. You can feel like the kind of divine rage coming up there. Mm-hmm. And as a people, when it came up, you know, en masse together as a cumulative, collaborative fury, that's what it takes to overturn these kinds of things. And I feel that we're up against it again.
No, I was just going to say, let's get to this election.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Sure. I feel like we're seeing it even worse and worse. I mean, when you have people who are millionaires and billionaires saying that, for example, the minimum wage is too high in this country.
Yeah, ridiculous.
I know people who work 3 jobs for minimum wage and cannot make ends meet.
And a lot of them are single moms.
You can't be serious, right? Mm-hmm. This is an outrage. Mm-hmm. It's an outrage. And anyone who calls himself spiritual and doesn't care about the conditions that are facing the average human being anywhere worldwide, but let's take our country for a moment here in the U.S. If that doesn't turn your heart inside out and upside down, then there's something wrong and you need to examine your spiritual life and your conviction, is my feeling. We have to stand for the poorest of the poor and we have to help them come out of that. Mm-hmm. We have to help the least of our brothers and sisters, right? I mean, this is a moral compulsion. I think it's also common sense.
And I think it's evolutionary too.
Yeah, but I mean, you don't have to have a lofty spiritual perspective to see this. It's just simple. A lot of people, I've seen people on Facebook that they'll write me backside, you know, privately in messages, and they'll say, wow, it's so interesting that you're a spiritual person and you're posting political things. And I'm thinking, they're inseparable to me. Mm-hmm. They're absolutely inseparable.
Well, Alex, I was really active in the 60s, right? And a lot of us were really heartbroken because we really believed. Mm-hmm. So I went in and became the intuitive I am and all these other things on an inner path, right? Mm-hmm. But I feel a lot of us are being drawn back out to really do what we can do. There's kind of a big wave.
What do you think of that?
Yeah, I really think it's happening. I'm watching it all around, right?
Well, and I think you have to watch how time operates in the layers of collective karma. You know, as a nation, we had a lot of change makers, and the duality between high divine change and vision and clarity and moral imperative and all that, and the forces of resistance to that, the negativity, the inertia, the negative karma, the blowback, were so intense that most of our not figurehead, but the leaders of real change, the really prominent characters, got killed in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And I think that destroyed people. It was extreme heartbreak, right? Especially after Martin and then Malcolm and Bobby. Oh, my God. Right?
Yeah, and then you think Rage Against the Machine and that kind of thing, right?
Devastating, right? Yeah. So then, but I think we went through a lot of karmas. And a lot of
and what is karma?
Country,
this is a silly question,
karma
maybe,
is nothing
but it's
action to reaction.
Okay,
it's the balance sheet of action to reaction.
Do you think every now? Human, one more question: do you think it comes through in waves? Do you think that we have a collective karma and dharma and an individual one? Right.
Correct. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sure. Human beings. Each one of us has an individual karma. That's to say, what you did in this life. Action to reaction. You do good stuff comes back. You do unfortunate things come back. But we also, each of us as an individual, have a multiple lives karma that also comes due and figures into what we're doing. So that's another layer of it.
And what about this shift? Was the shift, how would you perceive the shift?
Well, but what I'm seeing is as a nation, and there is also, to answer your question, collective karma, that as a country or a society or a group of people or an ethnicity or whatever, there's also a collective karma that also doesn't play out. So what I see is that when we came together to do the unthinkable, the impossible, and elected Barack Obama, a visibly black man as president of the United States. Wow. That was such a shift. And I think it wasn't as radical a shift as many of us hoped it would be, right?
Right.
He didn't turn out to deliver. However, I think it was such a radical change in the collective consciousness of this country that we could come together and do something like that, and that we merited karmically something like that, a person like that, who at least was a pretty good steward. You know, economically, things didn't collapse. Yes, he's more Republican than Democrat in many ways, especially his corporate and banking cronyism and so on.
But do you feel like he had a chance? Because I think maybe he got his feet caught in the wheels of the cogs of the machine in a way he couldn't. Or do you think he's just part of the machine?
Oh, I think he's part of the machine now. Mm-hmm. I don't know where he was to start with. But I think that was an essential step on so many levels. And in terms of social issues, look at what happened. You know, when he was elected, he couldn't even talk initially about Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
About what?
Don't ask, don't tell,
right.
The gay people in the military.
Right.
That was like, oh, dear me, don't touch that third rail. Oh, my gosh. And within a couple of years, that is eradicated. It doesn't even exist anymore, that policy.
Great.
You know, we've seen a lot of social changes for the better under his administration. And so I feel like it's an interim shift. And we also have seen that despite all the racism, bigotry, threats, and so on, that we've had a black president in the U.S. for almost 8 years now who has survived it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's of note. I think that we're seeing the changes coming layer by layer and in a positive direction. And I believe that my feeling is energetically that set the stage for Bernie Sanders to take the presidency of the U.S. and actually do the things that everyone is hoping can be possible as an expression of everybody's yearning. The collective desire, I think, has gotten so strong, especially over the last 8 years, for real palpable social equality for everybody, especially economic equality. And I think that the millennial kids now, who were maybe too young to vote when Barack Obama ran for the first time in 08, have come of age. And I think they've come of age with a completely different sensibility from many of the older generations. They're coming in as brighter souls. They're coming in with less karmic baggage, much more clarity, much more empathy for each other, much more of a kind of like, hey, let's help each other out collectively as a society. I've seen that many of the young people identify themselves as socialists. It's hilarious to me that the media right now and the sort of established corporate interests and even old guard politicians are throwing the word socialist around like an insult, completely not recognizing that to people under 30, capitalist is the problem.
Yeah, really.
And they're seeing it. So I feel like there is a revolution going on. And I
well,
think
as a Canadian, I think it's hilarious, the socialism paranoia.
I know, it's such a joke, right? It's just an invective at all. It's not an insult at all.
It's a naivety on Americans' part, which is responsive to their media mind, isn't it? It's responsive to, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, so you're saying that their voices are being raised in consciousness in a lot of ways,
yeah.
Right?
Yes, I do see it. And I feel like this election in particular, it's so outrageous, right? The opposite forces and so on. To me, it looks like a real do or die moment for the consciousness of the American people. You know, the English elected unthinkable Jeremy Corbyn, who is an incredible progressive. I mean, he makes Bernie Sanders look middle of the road. And that was like impossible. And the English media was all against him and slanders and attacks and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, well, he got elected. And then suddenly we see Canada suddenly elect young Trudeau, you know, who put 50% of the people in his cabinet are female. When they asked him why, he said, well, because it's 2015.
And he also has them all representing all these different socioeconomic gaps. Yeah. Good for
and
him.
Socioeconomic and also the ethnic makeup of Canada and so on. Mm-hmm. So I think you know, if England can do it and if Canada can do it, why couldn't U.S. also do it? I believe that the stage is set, and I think it's in the air, and I think it has to do with the young people. So I really see it as a, it's kind of like Star Wars, isn't it? I mean, it's like the forces of dark and the forces of light, and here they are playing out this epic battle in a clear way. It wasn't so clear with Barack Obama.
Well, I don't know if I'm just being
so polarized and outrageous.
I don't know if I'm just being arrogant here, but I also feel people in my age category who are active 60s people are standing forward again after sitting way back for
a
while.
I hope so. You know, I have to say, I just saw a thing on Facebook today. There's a beautiful group called the People for Bernie Sanders, who, when I joined it, were 30,000 strong, and now there are like 170,000 members. But there was a young woman, a millennial girl, who said, "I don't understand you baby boomers. Why are you not with Bernie Sanders en masse?" She said, "My parents marched for people they didn't even know in the 60s and 70s, and they stood for causes, and now they're completely throwing their lot in with the status quo represented by Hillary Clinton." She said, "I cannot even get them to cast a vote for Bernie Sanders to protect me and the future generations, who they do know." It should be pretty livid, you know, and the stats are, you know, women, especially over 50, really support Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, but here's something interesting is I am not a baby boomer. I'm older than that. I'm just before it. And a lot of the people in my age group are ready to step forward. We were not the
Isn't
one.
That
the, the baby boomers were more have. They were more, okay, I'll find my way in the system. You know, even maybe they dropped out for a little while. But a lot of us were a lot tougher than that and heartbroken. And I keep running into people my age who are, you know, I'm almost Bernie Sanders' age, actually. I am, actually. And there's a certain respect for him because of his wisdom, because of his track record, because of his revolutionary ideals, which are actually humanistic and socialistic. They're not that weird.
Correct. He's a spiritual figure, actually, is my feeling.
Yeah, so I would tell the millennials, look, come on, there's some hope here. There's some old folks that are going to stand behind you or beside you.
Correct. But I also think, and this is a curious thing in the, did you have to read Maureen Dowd wrote a beautiful column a few days ago in New York Times? About,
no, I didn't read it. Mm-mm.
It was hilarious about Sarah Palin saving feminism.
What? She's what? Saving feminism?
And the theme was this, that Sarah Palin, okay, so prior to Sarah Palin, if women were in politics, Hillary Clinton or before that Geraldine Ferraro, who had a, you know, not so great run for the vice president, that women coming out of the women's lib movement here in the 60s and 70s tended to identify with prominent female figures to the point that if they went down, those celebrity women, it was like a stain on all women in the country. So if, for example, Billie Jean King had lost the famous tennis match to Bobby Riggs, the great chauvinist, it would have reflected badly on all American women. Geraldine Ferraro not being vice president looked bad for all of us. And so it seems to be that there's this investment in Hillary Clinton that she stands for every woman. And this is, again, women of the boomer generation.
Oh, no, and she's
and the
not.
The women's lib generation identifying so strongly with her. Like, if she goes down, then that's a bad thing for all of us. But Sarah Palin, God love her, has proven that that's not the case because she's a woman in politics who's made a total jackass out of herself again and again. And it doesn't reflect on all women. It only reflects on her and the questionable choice of her by John McCain. So anyway, Maureen Dowd wrote this very funny column, but the underpinning of it is the younger women don't identify socially with our celebrities who are female in that way. It's sort of like only the 50 plus women who lived through the women's lib movement. And those are the ones who are supporting Hillary full tilt. And I feel like they feel that their identity, their validation in society, their status as women is validated if she wins. It's this old paradigm. And it's fascinating to me to see that, like, women of my age, I'm almost 50, I don't feel that way at all. I don't feel that she's a reflection of me in the least.
No, to me, she's just very much a part of that machine. She's just very, she may as well be the male, actually.
Correct. But she speaks to the heart of women who identify with celebrity women as a make it or break it for their own validation. And I feel like the generation of women's livers who were so entrenched in that investment in famous women doing okay, because then that lifted us all up somehow, are still operating with that investment. And I feel like that's why they're so tied to her. And also that she cries victim so much. And I feel like American women really relate to the feeling of victimhood because you're a female. And I feel like many of them are trying to get their own validation met by trying to get her elected as the first female president, even though, you know, frankly, she's more Republican than most. And certainly, I mean, I would love to see a female president, but I'd rather see someone like Elizabeth Warren, who stands for everybody.
Elizabeth Warren is also brilliant.
So she's great. She's great. Killer Mike, the great rapper who's out there supporting Bernie Sanders, he gave a speech in Atlanta a couple weeks ago, and he said, you know, I have lived long enough, and I do not want to see my country elect our own Margaret Thatcher.
Good. Good for him.
And I thought, wow, well said, sir. Well said. Yeah.
So what you're saying, Alex, what you're saying is she's a what woman? I'm sorry.
She's the wrong woman for the job.
Yeah, really. What about somebody like Gloria Steinem? This is a sidebar. I want to go back into something else.
But who endorsed Hillary?
Did she?
Yeah.
Okay. She just went off a pedestal for me.
Of course. Well, because it's that generation of women who are so invested in somehow that reflection of, if that famous woman is okay in the eyes of the public, then I'm okay too. It's a terrible. I think it's an illusion on the part of women of a certain age who feel that they need that kind of validation.
Huh. Well, I don't feel like that at all. So I feel
No. I can hear you're totally out of that.
Yeah. And but then I tend not to be a belonger. So what you're saying, if I were to kind of float around above us all and look down, you're kind of saying there's this wave moving through the collective that could bring a huge consciousness shift to the political realms. It could. But
I think the consciousness is already rising, and I think we're going to see it play out in the field of politics as well as many other fields in our country.
Okay.
I think the consciousness is already clearly on the rise. This many young people just galvanized for an old Jewish guy in his 70s? Are you kidding me?
But the thing with him is he has his track record of saying, hey, look,
utterly consistent.
And there's an elephant in the living room, everybody.
Yeah. And he's always on the side of the right stuff, right? He voted against the Iraq War and so on. He always supported women. He always supported civil rights.
And Warren Buffett said, I don't know if I'm going to vote for him, but I've never heard Bernie say anything that wasn't wise and true.
Yeah. See, and Buffett supported Hillary. I'm like, thanks a lot. You know, can you slap us a little harder there, Mr. 1%?
Yeah, but you know why he's doing that.
It's a boys club. They all have to support each other. They're all, you know, gajillionaires. Fine. Let them do it. I don't care.
But I think what's really interesting is you're talking about a huge wave of consciousness, and even him talking about how Bernie doesn't say anything that's nonsense is a kind of a support for that wave of consciousness, even though he's holding on to his territory.
Correct. And you're talking about paradigm shifting, right? So we're sitting right here in the middle of a pretty big paradigm. Not only, I mean, forget the right wing, forget the, you know, the crazy circus going on with the Republican Party in this country, which is its own funny dance. And I don't really have that much to say about it, except I think it's the negative side of consciousness showing itself. But when we look at the Bernie-Hillary dynamic, it really is that I feel the battle for the clarity and the consciousness of the American hearts. Mm-hmm. How open are our hearts? How much do we really deserve leadership that reflects open-hearted care for everybody? Mm-hmm. And that's on us. And I feel like Bernie wouldn't have gotten any traction at all were there not already a monumental shift in the consciousness, because people hear him. I actually went myself when he was here in LA with 27,500 other people.
I know. I saw you you were just lit.
I was blown away. Mm-hmm. And I don't think his message would resonate so deeply and so truthfully if people were not capable of hearing it, meaning that their consciousnesses are pretty high, pretty clear, and their hearts are open.
But it's sort of interesting, Alex, that even though he doesn't get top billing by the media, his ranks are growing and growing, and people, it's a social networking movement, really, isn't it? You know?
Social media is really captivated by him, of course. Yeah. And it can spread like wildfire. And the hilarious part is the media completely doesn't even pick up on that, or is studiously ignoring it. Or now they're starting to trash him because they're starting to see that he is, in fact, a real force. Fine. Who cares? The people who are not bound, you know, 20-year-olds do not get their news from MSNBC or CBS News or whatever. I hate to shock everybody. But they're getting it on the Internet. They're getting it on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and Reddit and all this. And if you look at Bernie's presence on social media, It is a tsunami.
Is it?
It's an absolute tsunami.
I guess
just
I better get at
contrast,
it.
A simple contrast. Whenever there's been a debate between Bernie and Hillary, mainstream media will come out with headlines like, oh, Hillary crushed it. Yeah, Hillary dominated. But when they do online polling and even focus groups, from Fox News to MSNBC or CNN, everybody says, oh, Bernie won. Like 80% of the viewers will say that. Every online poll at every online outlet, Time Magazine, CNN, it doesn't matter. Their users will say Bernie won, and they won't report it. So it's kind of like the people know the truth. You know, that's a thing that the Buddha said, right? There are a few things you can't hide, the sun, the moon, and the truth.
Right.
In India, the motto of India, you know, the country's motto, it's on their flag, I believe, it says in Sanskrit, Satyamev Jayate, in the end, the truth will win.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're seeing that the truth is out there, but only for people who have the eyes to see it. The truth is coming in these huge waves of people going to Bernie Sanders events, who are inspired and galvanized, willing to spend their hours phone banking. I saw on Twitter a couple of days ago, somebody tweeted from Iowa saying, oh my God, the phone banks are all full. You can't get a seat in a Bernie phone bank. That's how many people are coming out to volunteer to make his vision a reality, because it's their vision. It's our vision.
Hmm.
And his fantastic statement about it's not me, it's us.
Isn't that wonderful? I mean, we really are. I've said for years, I thought this was a revolutionary-based country. Where's the revolution? And what you're telling me is there is a wave of a revolution that's really
Absolutely.
Going on.
Yes. And I think it's divinely inspired and guided. And I feel like he is really the voice, because he's speaking about the simple, truthful, heartful realities.
Hmm.
People don't have enough. Other people have too much. That needs to change. We have to take care of each other.
Mm-hmm.
How is that not like, you know, Christ's message? And also that he went, you know, to Liberty University. I don't know if you caught this, but at the very beginning of the election cycle. So Liberty University, which is the staunch hotbed of radical evangelical Christian right-wing-ism,
mm-hmm.
started by Jerry Falwell and now presided over by his son. Liberty University typically... all the Republican candidates will go there and, you know, pledge their faith and talk about what good Christians they are and so on. They've had a standing invitation to all candidates, always. But no Democrat candidate ever took them up on it until Bernie Sanders went to Liberty University.
I did read about
that.
So he
got there.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God. So he got there. The 73 at that time year old Jewish man, who is staunchly pro-choice, you know, staunchly pro-gay rights and civil rights and so on. He came in there and he was so breathtaking. He said, look, I'm going to say right off the bat, and it was like 20,000 kids or whatever, because it's mandatory. They have to go to these the public events that happen there. They can't skip out on them. So you can bet that 90% of kids would rather have been anywhere else than hearing this guy talk about whatever he came to talk about. And he said, look, I'm going to lay it on the table. I'm pro-choice, you know. I support gay rights and marriage equality. We're going to disagree about those things. I'm okay with that. However, I think there are places where we can find common ground. And this is what I think they are. And he started talking about the least of my brothers and taking care of people who need it, and that this country is facing economic inequality and immense hardship for people at the bottom rung of the society and the middle class, which is fading fast. You know, people cannot afford their lives anymore. This is insane.
Mm-hmm.
And he spoke so truthfully and heartfully. He did quote the Bible. And he even quoted Pope John, Pope Francis, the current mm-hmm. Pope, talking about and also climate change and how we have to take care and address these things. I read many accounts of the Liberty University talk after I actually saw it. I mean, I was in tears, of course, through the whole thing. But there were kids who sat quietly after the whole crowd had left, sobbing in the bleachers, saying, my family is very well to do. We are staunch Republicans. I am a devout Christian evangelical. And my heart has been altered by hearing this man, because he is speaking the words of Jesus Christ. And I have to support that. Like, their minds were blown. Not everybody, clearly. And many of them are going to cling to their political conviction that, you know, abortion is the biggest thing and it's baby killing, and so they can't support somebody like Bernie Sanders. But I think his very humane, genuine message of helping all of humanity resonates very deeply, universally, with anybody who has the ears to hear it. And so I do think that there's a consciousness revolution going on. I thought it was tremendous that he went and did that.
Yeah, I heard something about it. No, I didn't read it as faithfully as you did. But it's funny because biblically speaking, we're supposed to be living into the book of Revelations. And to me, that just means so much is being revealed. And people are getting all the hoodwinking ripped off their vision, and they're beginning to see the corruption from levels they never saw before. And I think all of that is marrying what this is asking of us.
Correct. And I think that that's evidence of the consciousness on the rise. I don't think it's any more corrupt than it's ever been. I don't think it's any more extreme or outrageous than it's ever been in human history. I mean, think about the Roman Empire, for example, and the people living in slavery under that or whatever. But what I think is that people en masse, planet-wide, are seeing it. More clearly.
En masse with the internet and all that too. The en masse part has really expanded, and the wave is going tsunami wise, as you called it earlier. I'm very excited about these times. We all booked our attention on the shift for 2012, and I keep watching going, it's kind of a slower shift, but this is a part of it, isn't it? This is a part of a huge wake up that's going on all over.
Yeah, and it has to go step by step. Otherwise, the thing will crash, right? In some ways,
like the Egyptian spring.
The intensity of the 60s happened so fast that I think it was like a giant shiver in the negativity of the American society and the people who paid the price were the leaders at the head of the revolutions, Martin, Malcolm, Bobby. People gave their lives for civil rights. Many people died, were beaten, were, you know, horrible. This time, I think because of all that, it's smoothed out a lot, and it's going in a what do you say, like a regulated way, step by step. And I don't think it has to be the violent confrontation anymore. I think we're kind of out of that, and now it's more of like a consciousness confrontation.
Well, it's interesting because he doesn't get top billing, Bernie, for example, with our with our bot media. For a long time, I've watched this kind of lifting consciousness moving amongst people, and it hasn't been confrontational. It's been moving through. I remember years ago being told or taught that some people in high positions, even in the military, will start feeling the awakening in spite of themselves. And I'm kind of counting on that. That's a way of perceiving what's going on. What do you recommend for us all, Alex?
In what sense?
In the sense of waking up, in the sense of being very supportive of a consciousness shift so that man is looking after one another and of Mother. I keep putting on Facebook, Mother Earth also has the right to life. You know? So are you recommending to people, like I keep thinking we need to all raise our voices so that they get hooked up with one another, but is it through mantras, through praying, through... What would you suggest to people?
Oh, I think there are a lot of levels to it. I think every human being has the responsibility to see first with their heart, not with their mind, and to see inside how they really feel about all of this and to be true to that. I think that's the number one, like the surface thing that everybody can do. I think prayer for the greater good for everybody, let's say in our country, especially in this, you know, today is the Iowa caucuses, oh my God. going through this whole caucus and primary season, you know, to pray for the greatest good for the country, not for anybody's individual particular idea or agenda, but, you know, so that's like another level. Definitely, the other thing that I see in this country is a lot of heartbreak and cynicism, and I would say the number one disease that people are up against, from which everything else flows, all the other physical problems, emotional problems, anxiety, depression, and so on, is heartbreak.
Right.
And I see a lot of heartbreak politically that people are so sickened by corruption and business as usual that they feel like it's not even worth trying to get motivated again or inspired again.
That is the saddest thing in the world, isn't it?
Feeling the collective heartbreak of people who are suffering with cynicism and pain and depression and all like that, there I think it needs the supernatural. And I would say that's the place where mantra and high-level healing techniques, you know, ancient healing techniques come in. That's my little niche in the world, and what I try to do is help people dissolve their heartbreak.
Can you bring in some simple little, short meditation for people so that before we say goodbye?
You know, one of the most powerful things that people can do, and this will sound crazy because it is so simple, but every night before you go to sleep, thank your mother and your father for bringing you into this life. Not to say, because I know many people had traumatic family experiences or abusive parents or whatever, not to say thank you for everything that happened after that. But the parents, the physical mother, the physical father, they are actually the doorways to the divine mother and divine father, to the cosmic. And when we're thanking them for the gift that they gave us of our life, they gave us this body, right? They gave us this physical vehicle. When we do that, it's like 100 fire hormones.
Oh, really?
Wrapped into one straight shot. Yeah, it burns out so much negativity. It purifies so much. It can be a tremendous healing device. And they, because the physical parents, whether they're alive or dead, it doesn't matter. They're a doorway to the cosmic intelligence and the cosmic source. And so one very, very simple practice, I would say that everybody can do to start healing their own heartbreak on whatever level it exists, is simply to thank your parents before you go to sleep at night. How hard is that?
I love that. And also, I want to say this about you. You're the minister at Universal Church of Baba's Kitchen, UCBK. Mm-hmm. People mm-hmm. can get hold of you there. But what is Baba's Kitchen?
Oh, well, so my lineage of miraculous healing saints, which includes Sri Kaleshwar, the young man that I talked about at the beginning, his direct master was Shirdi Sai Baba, Sai Baba of Shirdi, the original Sai Baba, and who died in 1918. Shirdi Sai Baba was a tremendous miraculous healer, also on the lines of a Jesus, and in fact, closely aligned with and working in conjunction with Christ. So UCBK, which is actually .org, for people who want to look up the website and see more about all the stuff that we do, Baba's Kitchen, we needed to start an organization that could function as a church in the U.S. For legal reasons and all like that. And Baba's Kitchen came to us kind of almost joking in a conversation. And as we said the name, Baba's picture at a friend's house fell off their table.
Oh, wonderful.
And we're like, oh my God, check that out. He kind of likes that. And then we put the photo up again. And my friends who were scientists were like, no, that was just coincidence. Again, it came in conversation, the Church of Baba's Kitchen. And again, the picture fell off the shelf.
Wow.
At which
wonderful.
Point, my PhD in physics friends were, they had to admit that that was more than coincidence. And so we kept the name. So Baba's Kitchen, a kitchen is a place where a lot of alchemy happens, right? A lot of transformation happens.
You bet.
You take wet messes of stuff and then you subject it to heat and it turns into omelets or brownies or whatever. But also that people get fried in a kitchen. Their karmas can burn in a kitchen. And also that as a spiritual organization, we thought, well, the world is really starving on many levels. It's starving in some cases for food, for just material help. So we have a big wing of social service doing homeless lunches and helping do healing for our veterans who are suffering post-traumatic stress. But the world needs healing. It's hungry for that. It's also hungry for divine love and for inspiration and for knowledge. So like we do a lot of teaching, we do a lot of healing. We operate on many levels and all of that seems fitting to come from a kitchen, especially under Baba's, Shirdi Sai Baba's guidance and under his domain. So
I
that's
love
how
that.
It came around.
I love that. Yes, well, Alex Edelman, you are so interesting. And I'd like you to come back maybe over the next month or so, if you will. We haven't even touched the Homas and various other ceremonies
right.
and things that you do that are so transcendent. And I'd like
great.
To talk about those.
Yeah, great.
Well, thank you so good. Well, please come back. And so it's UCBK, mm-hmm. Universal Church of Baba's Kitchen.org, mm-hmm. and people can get
yes.
hold of you there if they want more information.
Correct. Yeah.
Thank you, Alex.
Yes. Oh, thank you so much, Veronica, and have a lovely, lovely day.
You too. Thanks for being on the planet. This is Veronica Entwistle saying thank you so much for listening to Paradigm Shifters. Podcasts are available very soon, and you can be in touch with me at veronicaentwistle.com. Good night.